And so we had a chat about it, and we thought, well, this is great, because this fills one of the gaps that we were definitely thinking about, because we were running through sort of rebellions and riot that were associated with enclosure and that long process that occurred in Britain. And Kent Rebellion was actually in one of the films we made. Rich, who's out on the door at the moment, you can talk to him later, but he researched the Kent Rebellion, put it into his Flash Player movie, which we did in the first History Week. So we've always been interested in it. We're kind of trying to find somebody who knew about it. And there we go, down a market in town, we meet the person who knows somebody, and that's how a lot of the events are actually organised from this. You'd be surprised by talking to people and then in pubs or in other places, and then they put us on to people. And we discover historians quite regularly in pubs in Bristol. So, and we usually find they're frustrated as well, so it's not difficult to get them out and do a talk. But Peter, you know, it's been very kind to come along for this talk. The same thing is to say is that also a couple of years ago, somebody, I can't remember her name, she came up to us and said, oh, there's this really great book you need to read. In fact, you need to like kind of get hold of it for your bookstore and that, called The Lefty's Guide to Britain. It's like, right? And we said, what's that? And they said, oh, it's kind of like random history, you know, you can kind of go out of the country and visit different things. So it sounded very interesting, but as far as I know, I think it's out of print now, is that right?
Shouldn't be.
Well, we've had trouble getting hold of it, but Peter, I think, edited that book, is that right? So I would, although I haven't read it myself, I haven't been able to get hold of it, being in charge of the bookstore, Peter's Lefty Guide to Britain is something you might want to look at if you're interested in radical history around the country. So that's pretty much all I'm going to say. Just a couple of little things. If you don't know already, the toilets, you go down the stairs along here and you'll see the blue doors at the end of the sign if you need to go out. If there's a fire, I meant to tell you, we go out quietly down the stairs and cross over the road through the blue gate, out through the entrance you came in and across the road. So toilets, fire, I've covered it all now. So I'm just going to hand over to Peter.
Okay, thank you. In July and August 1549, there was a sudden explosion of popular protest in Norfolk, the Kett Rebellion. And it was led by a man called Robert Kett from the town of Windham, just to the south west of Norwich. And Robert Kett was a prosperous farmer who was also a landowner and a tanner, and from a well-established family in Windham. He led this rebellion, this army of peasants and craftsmen, more or less, and they started tearing down the fences of recently enclosed land. And suddenly, the whole of Norfolk burst into flames, into a kind of social protest. And within days, Kett rallied a lot of people at an oak tree, which you can still see near Windham, and something like 12,000 people from the area walked up north of Norwich and settled on Mousehold Heath, which is just to the east of Norwich. And a whole lot of other people came to join them on Mousehold Heath, up to about 20,000 people. Quite extraordinary, all within a few days. It was a challenge to the authorities, and a herald came from London and asked them to disperse, and they would be forgiven. And they said, we haven't done anything wrong, so there's nothing to forgive. And so they refused. And then they took over Norwich. Norwich surrendered to them fairly sensibly, because there weren't many defences in Norwich, which had a population of about 15,000 at the time. So you had 20,000 people outside. And the castle in Norwich was fairly useless, because it had been built to keep the people of Norwich in control, not to be a base for a possible civil war in the area. Anyhow, 20,000 people settled at Mousehold Heath and also occupied the city of Norwich. And the government in London sent up an army under someone called Northampton, and there was fighting in the streets of Norwich, and the rebels defeated the army, and Northampton went back to London defeated. A month later, a bigger army came out under another soldier called Warwick, Lord Warwick. And he was far more of a soldier, far more astute. he besieged the city, took it over, but there was a lot of fighting in the streets, and the rebels withdrew from the city up to Mousehold Heath again. And at the end of August, there was a big battle at Dussindale, not far from Norwich, and quite a slaughter. Something like 3,000 of the rebels were slain. Robert Kett was captured, taken to London, put in the Tower, tried, and sentenced to death. And he was brought back to Norwich and was hanged outside the castle at the end of December. His brother, who had been participating also in the rebellion, was taken to Windham and hanged from the church tower there. So that is the Kett Rebellion. I could stop here, but I will carry on for another few minutes. I want to talk about five aspects of it. First of all, what was the state of England at that time? Secondly, what was the state of Norfolk for this to have happened? Thirdly, I want to look at the issue of enclosures. Fourthly, the character of the rebellion. And finally, the legacy of the rebellion. This England in 1989. That charismatic bully, King Henry VIII, had died in 1547, 2 years before. His only son, Edward VI, became king at the age of 9 years old, and the power in the land was the boy's uncle, Somerset, Duke of Somerset, who was seen as a, quote, the good duke. He was seen as, in Tudor terms, more liberal than King Henry VIII, which wasn't too difficult. He made things easier. Henry VIII had imposed some fairly draconian treason laws. These were lightened. Somerset was also seemed to have a rapport with people, and he could see that the enclosed land, the building of the enclosures, was harming the interests of the poor. And he set up commissions to listen to what people had to say. So he also helped to the poorer classes to have access to legal aid at the time. So the Duke of Somerset was the power in the land. 1549 was just 15 years after the Reformation, and one has to sort of think oneself into the situation at the time. The Reformation, the previous 20 years, had been a generation of enormous social and political upheaval. Not just the destruction of the church and the church properties. The church had owned something like 15% of all agricultural land in the country, and this was, as it were, nationalised and redistributed. But there had been inflation over the last 50 years, there were economic changes, and Henry VIII had favoured a lot of new men, lawyers and new civil servants. And when he had taken the church property, these were often sold cheap or handed over to what you might call new men. And in the 1540s, there became, for the first time within living memory, enormous disparities of wealth. Extremely rich people, some people, especially the civil servants or people who had been close to the king, who had been able to get various concessions, and lawyers in particular, who had become powerful and rich. The Reformation, of course, had changed religious allegiances, but in Norfolk, was, generally speaking, all in favour of the Reformation. It had been strong philology, sort of Ur-Reformation a century or so earlier. It was also a very strong county in support of Cromwell and the Puritan rebellion a century later. So there was no problem about that. In contrast to a rebellion that was going on also in the 1540s against the crown in the west of England, where in Cornwall people rose up and started a march on London, and this was put down. But they were for the old faith and against all the new Protestant reforms. But in Norfolk, that wasn't an issue at all. In 1549, a new prayer book was being issued, and in the West Country there had been opposition to this prayer book. In Norfolk, it was totally accepted, the new prayer book, the new Protestant prayer book. Also in the 1540s, and this was another preoccupation of the London government, there was sort of intermittent war with both Scotland and with France. Henry VIII had wanted the infant Mary Queen of Scots to marry Edward VI. The Scots didn't want that, and the Scots were in alliance with France, and so there was a kind of simmering war against both countries. So you've got the social upheaval, political upheaval, a change of dynasty, a strong charismatic king, a boy king, wars to the north and to the south, rebellion to the west and to the east. So that was the state of England in the 1540s. But another interesting feature, I find, of the 1540s was that above a certain threshold, social threshold, there were all extraordinary linkings of families, of the aristocracy and gentry, right up to the royal family. Even Kett, who was a prosperous farmer, you can trace marriage alliances in his family that go to all the leading figures of the time and going right up to the royal family. And this was common with a lot of the squirearchy and the aristocracy at the time. I say above a certain threshold. Below a certain threshold, that didn't happen. But it was one of the significant things about the Norfolk Rebellion. Most of the people involved on both the royal side and on Kett's side were somehow above a certain social threshold related, oddly enough. And this comes to the situation in Norfolk. Until the 1540s, the Gauleiter of Norfolk had been Thomas Howard, the Duke of Norfolk. He had been enormously powerful, and although he was a Catholic in the 1540s, he had still done well out of a lot of church lands. And there was a whole network of support, influence, patronage that he had in Norfolk. But he fell foul of Henry VIII, and in the early 1540s, he was dispossessed of most of his property. He was also a cousin of one of the executed queens of King Henry VIII, which didn't help. So you had this, as it were, Gauleiter of Norfolk, the Duke of Norfolk, dispossessed. And so there was something of a power vacuum at the top in Norfolk. But socially below there, there were dozens of squires, old families that had local influence. Families like the Pastons, who wrote the letters of the 15th and 16th century. There was a family, Windham, W-I-N-D-H-A-M, Beddingfield. But all these were fairly prosperous people who had local influence. But there was no single figure who had an influence over the whole of the county. And these families, these squirish families, both competed with each other and intermarried. Again, you have all sorts of interesting tensions there. Then, in addition to the squires in Norfolk, you had what you might call the new men, lawyers and civil servants. And one of the events that sparked off the whole riots was there was a man called John Flowerdew, who was a lawyer, who was an escheator, somebody who dealt with forfeited land. And he had property about here, and the peasants starting the revolt went to tear down enclosures that he had put up. And John Flowerdew said, well, Robert Kett's put up some enclosures, why don't you go to him? And so they did go to him, and that's when he actually joined the rebellion. He said, quite right, I shouldn't put up these enclosures, tore them down himself, and went and tore down John Flowerdew's fences, and then gathered his following at Kett's Oak nearby. And you can go to Kett's Oak, which is on the old A11, I think it is there. Anyhow, somebody like John Plowdew, who was very unpopular because he was going around, very smart, a new man, collecting lots of property, lots of new estates. And someone like Plowdew was the first target of the rebels. In Norwich itself, Norwich and Bristol for many years have been the two second cities of the England, dominated by the cathedral. And you might think the church might have been important, or the cathedral might have been important during the rebellion. Oddly enough, it took no part whatsoever. Partly, I think, because there'd been a bishop, Rugg, whose brother was occasionally mayor of Norwich. Rugg had been disgraced. The Dictionary of National Biography says that he resigned bishopric through financial embarrassments, 1549. I'm not quite sure what they were, but he was very much in the shadow. So the cathedral as a power during the Kent Rebellion was of no significance at all. Norfolk was a prosperous county, and if you travel around, there's an enormous amount of very fine buildings built by prosperous people, churches and houses from the late 15th century and early 16th century. Norwich is particularly good with grand early Tudor houses, and this is a sign of the prosperity of the country. And the prosperity was had been mainly corn and wool, and the corn was produced at a surplus and exported both to London and to the continent. Yarmouth and Wells next to the sea were ports going to the Netherlands at that time. The smaller farms tended to produce corn with a few sheep. And it was the larger landowners that developed the interest in large sheep farms, and there was a push in the 16th century, early 16th century, for large sheep farms. And this led to the enclosures. As I said a moment ago, the county was generally pro-Reformation, but there are always little oddities in it. Windham had a big abbey, which was dissolved. And someone like Kett had a sentimental feeling for the abbey. It was in some ways a sentimental feeling for the institution, the local institution of the abbey and the last prior. And the abbey was dedicated to a couple of people, including St. Thomas of Canterbury. And on the 7th of July, there was always a fair in Windham. And again, the whole revolt started with people gathering at the fair, the St. Thomas of Canterbury Fair. And what makes it interesting is that Thomas of Canterbury was anathema to Henry VIII. Thomas of Canterbury was the churchman who defied the king in the 12th century, and everything that King Henry VIII didn't like. But nonetheless, you have these sort of pockets of paradox and inconsistency there. St. Thomas of Canterbury was a revered local saint. His fair was an annual event, and people would come from the villages for the fair, and it was these people who'd come from the villages that talked about enclosures, talked about fences being torn down, and that started the whole rebellion. That triggered off the whole rebellion. Now, the issue of enclosures. The common land was used by all the poorer classes, and in Norfolk and in other parts of the country, it was abundant. And the poorer people might have a plot of arable land, and they may have one or two, a few animals, cows, pigs, and these would be on the common land. There was no question about that. And the common lands also provided fuel, trees and wood and collapse, so people would gather fuel for the winter from the common lands. There were also lots of plants and herbs, and it became a kind of sort of chemist shop. People would go out and get particular plants for illnesses and so on. And so when land was enclosed, all these things that people took for granted were cut off. But looking at it carefully, rights were very ill-defined. It was something, because there had been an abundance of common land, the rights of anyone to that land were ill-defined. And the richer people argued, we have plenty of cattle, we have plenty of sheep, this was the main thing, we have plenty of sheep, and so we have a right, because we have more sheep than anyone else, to look after them on this common land. Enclosures, and this is one of the arguments they use for enclosures, enclosures had also developed in another way. Medieval farming was often very irrational, with people owning strips here, strips there, all over the place. And it was, quote, uneconomical, unquote. And often enclosures developed as a result of negotiation. People would say, if you have my strip, I'll have that bit, and I can enclose that, and that will be all mine. And some of these strips of land had been fairly open, not overused, but it was a mixture of the more powerful taking over the land. But the thing is that the rights were, I don't like using the word traditional, because things are never static, but the rights were inherited and assumed, and there was a kind of a customary right to the open land, and these were being forfeited during the 16th century. And the bigger farmers and the new men who took over land saw profits in sheep, and they would enclose a large area of land for sheep, and you only needed one shepherd to look after something like 1,000 sheep. Whereas when there was arable land, as well as sheep and animals, you needed far more people. So the switch from arable farming to sheep farming meant unemployment for a lot of the people. And there were cases of cottages being pulled down. And enclosures were not just taking over land. It was depriving people of a right to live and look after themselves. And so sheep became a symbol that was very unpopular. But basically, what was happening was there was a competition for land utilisation. A customary belief that people had the entitlement to this land against people often from a new class, the lawyers, the new class of people, and also quite a number of the older established people carving up the country and taking possession of it. But because of this, not only was the land taken away, it led to landless poor, and poor people moved away from their livelihoods, roaming the country. One of the reasons why the government was concerned about this and listening to the poorer people is that those people often served in armies. They were useful cannon fodder. And Somerset's policy of being seen as sympathetic to the poor was partly with the interest that he didn't want to lose his supply of potential soldiers. Anyhow, that was the issue of enclosures that led to this sudden explosion of feeling in Wyndham in July 1549. I outlined the course of the rebellion, and I want to say something about the character of the rebellion. At one stage, the rebels issued demands. There was a kind of a 29-point manifesto that mentioned enclosures, but it also mentioned several other things that made it very interesting. It objected to the indiscriminate building of dovecotes. And actually, on their journey up there, there was one rich landlord here, and they destroyed the dovecot. And the whole point about this is that the pigeons in the dovecot were seen as the enemy of the small arable farmer. And so for the poor person with just a small plot of land, pigeons and dovecotes were something to be attacked. So among the demands, there was a demand for a restriction on dovecotes. There was also, interesting, something on the churches and on the priests. It wasn't anti-Reformation, but it was concerned with priests carrying out pastoral duties. They didn't want priests to be too rich. They wanted them to be concerned with education in the parish. And a common theme in a number of these demands was a restoration of the rites and customs of two generations earlier. Two or three times they talked about the state of the status quo when King Henry VII came to power, 1485, and this is 60 years later. So there's the idea of a golden age, two generations earlier, and before all these changes of the Reformation and all these social changes. There was also a hostility to lawyers, and those of you who have looked at the 15th century revolt, Jack Cade, one of the things, and Shakespeare uses this in Henry the Sixth, Part Two, when he has a bit on the Cade Rebellion, based in Kent. One of their slogans was, "Let's go and kill all lawyers." And so there's this radical objection to lawyers that comes again into the Kent Rebellion. But there are one or two other interesting things about the rebellion and what they were talking about. There was a list. Kett, in his camp, set up a kind of a parliament. He got people from different hundreds represented among the rebels, and he got a kind of a council, two or three people from each of about 800 or 900 in Norfolk. And what is interesting is that the poorest parts of Norfolk didn't join the Kett rebellion. It was people who were moderately prosperous already, people with secure jobs. So in some ways, a Marxist might see this as something of a bourgeois revolution. It was not the totally dispossessed or the poor. The hundreds where they came from had no part in the rebellion. It was competition for limited resources, people who might be aspiring. And when we have a list of the, as far as we know, names and the jobs, there are a lot of peasants, small farmers, and craftsmen who are among the supporters. But the language of some of these demands made from the camp, again, are very interesting, because they echo the peasants' revolt of 1381, and they pre-echo some of the radical demands of the Civil War, the Putney debates and so on. I'll just give you one or two lines. "We pray that all bondmen may be made free, for God made all free with his precious blood shedding." And this is very much of a medieval idea of a community of everybody, an egalitarian claim. And I think of when Adam delved into Eve's span, who was then the gentleman, the slogan of the peasant revolt in 1381. Another of their demands was, "What we want is liberty and the power, in common with our so-called superiors, of enjoying the gifts of nature." That echoes in the past and right down to the right down to the present. You can't really argue with that, and it's, although it's 1549, it could be 2008. At one stage, when the rebels were moving around Norfolk, they stole some sheep from one farmer called Pratt, appropriately, and chanted, "Mr. Pratt, your sheep are very fat, and we thank you for that. We have left you the skins to pay for your wife's pins, and you must thank us for that." So there was also a touch of humour in the revolt. The camp itself, I mentioned there was a kind of a parliament, people from all the hundreds. It was orderly, and there were daily prayers using the new Book of Common Prayer, so it was clearly not anti-Reformation. It was a social objection, not a religious objection, or even a political objection. And Kett issued instructions in the king's name. He commandeered supplies, and there was all the form of a mini-state. And he felt that he was in the king's name, and it was the king's advisers, as it were, who were misleading the king. I mean, one of the things I think, when you look at this, I mean, we're looking at it in hindsight, the whole thing just suddenly exploded. And in some ways, they wonder, what the hell have we started? You know, here's the beginning of July. 3 days later, they had this huge camp on the heath, and they set up this kind of commune, this kind of government. And, you know, there were no precedents for this. What were they going to do? And so this is how it actually worked out. There was also a tree there, which they called the Tree of Reformation, and they had trials there, a judicial procedure. They had taken hostages, some of the gentry, but they were generally well-treated, and in some ways they collaborated. They were virtually allies, and some of the hostages, both senior people from Norwich, from the city council, and other squirish people, their skills were used by the rebels. In the final battle at Dussindale, the gentry were chained together and acted as a human shield. But they all survived. None were killed in that final battle. There was generally a courtesy towards visitors. There were several people who came. It seems to be a bit like Greenham Common in the 80s. Several people would go and visit them, including people from the city. Even when preachers came to, they'd be visiting preachers, and the preachers would generally say, you've got to surrender. But they were treated with courtesy. And there were only two instances of bloodshed there. Just before the second final battle, there was a herald came from the government with the same message saying, surrender and you will be pardoned. And there was one boy there who just sort of lifted up his, put his trousers down and sort of mooned at the herald, who then shot him. there's a hero, isn't he? And that was one incident. And on another occasion, when Warwick, the second soldier, occupied Norwich, he had a number of Italian soldiers, and this was greatly resented by the people on Mousehold. And once Italian soldiers strayed out of Norwich into the camp, and he was summarily hanged. But these instances were unusual, unprecedented. But one of the questions that strikes me is that Kett didn't really have a long-term policy, partly because it had all happened so quickly. He sort of settled there, and then what was he going to do? He couldn't take over the country. He more or less had to wait for an army to come. And even if he defeated an army, as he did the first time round, what next? So there's a kind of inevitability about the final outcome. Mm-hmm. Kett made no attempt to march on London or anything like that, as the Western rebels thought of doing in the same decade. So there was this inevitability that they were going to be crushed. And so we come to the final points of the legacy of the rebellion. It was a failure. Enclosures went on, and indeed opposition to enclosures was seen as treasonable. Somerset's enclosure commission, these commissions that went round the country to listen to complaints of the poor, that collapsed. Somerset himself fell from power, and for a while he was in the Tower of London in another suite of rooms from those that the two Kett brothers were in. Somerset was replaced as Lord Protector by Warwick, who became the Duke of Northumberland. In the final battle, something like 3,000 of the rebels were killed. It was a triumph of artillery over bows and arrows, although Kett did have some artillery. After that, hundreds were hanged. But Warwick actually pleaded for mercy for a lot of them. It wasn't a total wipeout. And he said very significantly, would you be ploughmen yourselves and harrow your own land? So you didn't hang people because they had to be looking after the land. So as a result of this, a lot of rebels actually survived. I reckon perhaps 12 to 15,000 who had been in the camp probably survived all the trouble. All this was nearly 500 years ago. Looking at the accounts of the rebellion, how do we know about it? There were two 16th century accounts that were virtually eyewitness accounts. Both were hostile. In the 18th century, the major Norfolk County historian, Broomfield, who was a Tory churchman, was also unsympathetic, but he did give a lot of account of what happened. And it was only in the 19th century that Kett started getting a more sympathetic press, and another parson called Russell wrote sympathetically of the whole rebellion. And in the 20th century and later, there have been much more measured and sympathetic accounts, putting things into the wider social context. It can be argued, and was argued for many years, that the larger farms were more economic and more profitable, and that the enclosures led to the agricultural improvements, the agricultural revolution of the later centuries, especially the 18th century. It's argued that that wouldn't have happened if there was still the strip farming and still the access to commons. On the other hand, when there are social measures like this, clearly you have to take so many other things into consideration. I think one of the other consequences, which again affected the poor, was that a cash economy was forced more into the system. I mean, when you used your common land as a place to get your fuel, or the place as a chemist shop, and you were denied that, then there was the development of other professions, other careers, including the apothecary, and people had to use cash. So where there'd been barter or just living on a minimum of use of cash, cash became much more important in the 16th and 17th centuries. But I go back, what I find very interesting, it's the language that was used, the quotations I gave you. These echo, these are dealing with a contemporary issue, but they echo centuries back and echo pre-echo centuries forward. And some of the language used could be used today. The issue of the Kett Rebellion lived on. In 1949, 400 years after the hanging of Kett, a plaque was put up in Norwich Castle with contrite words acknowledging that Kett had been a friend of liberty and more or less saying, terribly sorry we strung you up. Mm-hmm. But at the time, and during the 20th century, and I've seen this in the very interesting museum in Wimbledon, there was quite an interesting debate in the local press. Some people still felt that Kett was a dangerous rebel, and you shouldn't acknowledge him, and you shouldn't see him. He was attacked as a subversive, which of course he was. And at Wimbledon, the abbey, the church there, there has been an attempt to get a plaque recognising the fact that here Robert Kett's brother William was hanged, but the church has refused this, and there is no plaque there. I think there's still a quiet wish to get that going. But the issues of the Kett's Rebellion, especially enclosures, lingers on right to the present day. 100 years ago, there was in a 1910 election, I remember reading about one of the songs there, which went, the land, 'twas God that gave the land, the land, the land, the land on which we stand. Why should we be beggars with the ballot in our hand? God gave the land to the people. And and then, thank you. And then, even in the last few years, there's a whole issue of the right to roam. And there was a piece in today's Guardian about talking about the issues of fencing off gardens squares and gardens in London. So what Kett touched on was a social issue which is as relevant today as it was in 1549. Thank you.
OK, if anybody's got any questions, then I'm going to put the kettle on and you can ask some questions.
Yes.
I bought the yes. booklet for you.
Is it yours?
Yes.
Oh, great.
And
Now, Newell, yes. was he
yes.
one of the people on the Parliament?
I was going to ask about Simon Newell.
Well, I only discovered it this evening. I mean, it was published last year, I see. Yeah. And I glanced at it. But I mentioned that there was a kind of a parliament on Mansfield Heath, and there are the names of the people representing different hundreds. And I suspect Simon Newell was one of those people,
right.
and it was a descendant of his who knew that this was his forebear and wrote the pamphlet. I glanced at it just half an hour before this talk. I didn't know of it before.
I've always assumed that the enclosure moon was a couple of centuries later. Why didn't this issue arise? Why was it only there? Was it to do with flatlands and sheep, or if so, why didn't that rise?
Well, there were and this is a sudden explosion, but there've been pockets of resistance in East Anglia generally and in other parts of the country. But it all came together quite extraordinarily. With the Kett Rebellion. But the enclosures in years later were then through parliamentary acts, weren't they?
Oh, I see.
And again, it was the landed class who dominated Parliament and who were able to get it. But I think the situation was more fluid and uncertain at this time. There was abundant land, and then there was a kind of a competition for the land. And the people, the rich sheep owner would say, look, I have 90% of the sheep in this area, so I'm entitled to close off this bit of land.
It seemed to me that I was always under the impression that if there was a common, there were certain people who were commoners, others who weren't, who couldn't use the common. And that
yes.
the common rights were guarded jealously by those people. For instance, when the diggers were driven off, I think they were driven off by commoners.
Oh, really?
They were, yes. the landlords
yes.
got the peasants to say, these people are taking your wood.
Yes.
Drive them off.
Yes.
And so I'm not sure about that.
Yes. I can't answer with authority, but what I do know is that there were all sorts of there was a great variety in ownership of land and use of land around the country. Very local customs and so on. And I'm sure you're right. But I can't remember the detail of it, but there was something like four different ways of owning land in Norfolk at the time. And that was Norfolk. There were particular Norfolk terms that weren't in use in other parts of the country. But I'm sure what you say is right with the diggers.
And the other?
Yes.
Did Kett have a family, and were his lands confiscated? What happened to his?
He was one of several brothers. William Kett, who was hanged from Windham Church, was an older brother, but he had younger brothers and descendants, and they managed to redeem themselves, as it were. Within a generation or two, there were lots in Norfolk and in East Anglia generally. And there's a firm in Cambridge called Ratty and Kent, Ratty and Kett, and this is from that family. There was a Kett who was a mayor of Cambridge about 100 years ago and wrote a family history tracing them down. So they did recover.
Did the Herald survive with his life after shooting the boy who
I'm not sure. Yes, it would be interesting to find the name of that boy and sort of say, look, he was a hero.
What is the tell me about the numbers of people. Were they all men, or was it men and women?
Well, there were women there too. The only story that we know, the only Mrs. Kett was there on the camp, and she only appears once in the whole Kett story, and that was on the eve of the battle, the final battle, when a snake came out of a tree and sort of leapt into her bosom. And this was seen, this is the only mention of her, we don't know anything, and it was seen, probably quite rightly, as an ominous, a bad omen. But we, I reckon there were, I mean, it's only men that we know by name there, and the parliament was made of men. But we've got a list of all the men who were in this sort of parliament from the different hundreds of Norfolk, and there are some from North Suffolk.
Is there any reason to believe that Kett really is a friend of liberty? I mean, it just seems the most remarkable part of the whole story that he was living quite happily as a member of the lower aristocracy, and then all of a sudden he's confronted by 12,000 people who he suddenly leads, dismantling, you know, the regime that he was part of. This,
yes,
incomprehensible.
Well, I think it's almost almost incomprehensible. It's an extraordinary story, and I mean, I come back to what strikes me. I mean, on the 6th of July, everything was all right. On the 7th of July, there was a sudden explosion, meeting, tearing down enclosures. Something started that Kett found himself at the head of. It couldn't be reversed, and there was a kind of an inevitability that they went round to Mount Sort. Nobody, as far as I can see, knew what they were going to do the next day. There was sort of inevitability. And in terms of your question, friend of liberty, what I find very interesting is that the whole story, in some ways, is symbolic. I mean, it touches a nerve on the whole of English history and English liberties. And they also used the language of liberty and rights. The manifesto that they produced, and as Kett was symbolic to the head, then I would accept him as a friend of liberty.
Well, that's a question.
Yes,
I'm sort of interested in what the nature of the regime was, say in Norwich, the townspeople.
Yes.
And what relationship they had to the farmers,
yes,
and the peasants.
Okay. Yes.
Now, because at that time there was a very strong guild system, mm-hmm, and there'd be a hierarchy of the town,
yes,
presumably.
Yes.
Of patricians and
masters
and journeymen. Yes. Were they? How were they related to
the
rebellion?
Well, there's no simple answer. A lot of the big families would have a townhouse in Norwich. There were also merchants in Norwich, and there was a corporation, and there were people running that. But when the 20,000 people were around there, they weren't going to take on a head-on collision. And so the mayor of Norwich went to the camp, and the deputy mayor was left behind. And I think these upper bourgeois merchants who did well out of the prosperity of the county, they were very nervous, and they parleyed with the rebels, they were also aware. I mean, Norwich was quite a big city, 13,000 at the time. There was common land within the towns, and there was a lot of sympathy with a lot of people, the poorer people, with the rebels. And I mentioned when Warwick, one of the battles was actually in the streets of Norwich, and in the second time the Royal Army came, there was more or less hand-to-hand fighting. If you know Norwich, it's there's still narrow streets there, and there was sort of hand-to-hand fighting between the people of Norwich who were sympathetic with rebels against the others. So, and bear in mind, Norwich had a population of 13,000 to 15,000 at the time. The rebels were 20,000. The people in charge of Norwich were very nervous. They had no precedent to know how to act. Things were not clear. A royal army, the first one was duffed up. The second one was several days away.
What I was wanting to know really was, did people in Norwich take part in the rebellion?
Yes.
Were they part of this mousehold?
Yes. A lot went out and joined the camp. But when Kett took over the town, they didn't have to be out in the camp. So you had two foci, you had the city, and not everyone would have been for the rebels in the city, but Kett had physical control of the city after the first heralds told him to surrender. So for about a month, 5 weeks, he had physical control of the city. Is it tea time?
Tea time, yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, thank you.